Member Week is here at Lowe's. That means it's time for MyLowe's Rewards members to save big with up to 40% off hundreds of items like appliances, tools, home essentials, and more. Plus, get free standard shipping. Shop these exclusive member-only savings now through October 15th. Not a rewards member? Join for free today. Free standard shipping not available in Alaska and Hawaii. Exclusions and more terms apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
In all the previous cases that I've been involved with, where the situation is like this here, it's always been a recovery. It's never been a...
Please, God. Please, God.
A happy ending.
Bring her home.
You will start to question whether a memory is real or false, only when that element of memory or that...
Why did his father leave him in a ditch in the middle of nowhere, then lie about it and disappear?
From eye scrapings and evasive nose probings to incisions in the skin, John of God has performed countless unlicensed surgical procedures, seemingly with no anesthesia, on enraptured followers.
Hawaii police who found Lori Vallow in Kauai with her new husband, Chad David.
Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners. Happy New Year! I missed you guys. What I didn't miss is the fact that Greg has a mustache right now, but, you know, you win some, you lose some. And I feel like we did lose a good one today, which kind of broke my heart. It feels like, I don't know. I only met him once, and it seems like I'm being too intense about it, but Kate texted me that Bob Saget died, and as I was finishing this episode and, you know, putting the final touches on and getting ready to record, that's when I found out, and I started crying. I guess I'm a psycho, and I am sensitive about everything. No, but truly, he did do one of the nicest things that anyone has ever done for me in the comedy realm that really touched my heart, and he did not need to be so kind to me. So I met him kind of randomly. One of my friends was doing the talk show Watch What Happens Live, and Bob Saget's wife, I believe, was like the bartender on the show. I can't quite remember, but I do know Bob Saget was there in the audience, and my two friends were the guests on the show. And so afterwards, you take a photo, and I was just there, I had meetings in New York at the time, and so I went with my friend. And so afterwards, you take a photo, and so me and Bob both joined in on the photo because our, you know, friends and family were involved in the show. And I don't know, I guess we all just kind of became close enough that we went out together afterwards. And Bob and I were talking, and I told him I was a comedian, and I was obviously about, 100 times less successful and further along in my career than him, but I was just kind of telling him, just about my comedy journey. And he couldn't have been more kind, not pretentious, not... I mean, honestly, you wouldn't even know that he was a successful TV actor, comedian in the way that he treated everyone around him. He was extremely kind to me, and he went out of his way more so than almost any... I'm not going to compare it to any other favor or kindness that someone in the entertainment industry has shown me, but it really did stand out in my mind. I could not believe how kind he was. So I'm telling him, I kind of have to book a lot of my own shows, and, you know, it's shitty to be a girl in comedy, you know, all that bullshit. And he told me that he thought I needed a comedy special. And I was like, yeah, I mean, yeah, that'd be cool. And he was like, well, let me help you with that. He said, I just did a special with this company. I don't think I'm going to say their name. And I think that they would love you. And I think that you should work with them. And so in that moment, it might have been 1 a.m. at that point, which I never stay up that late. But Watch What Happens Live goes super late. And then we were all hanging out. And He literally emailed them in front of me in that moment saying, this girl is funny. She deserves a shot. You know, give her a shot. And I really thought I'd have to follow up afterwards. Or I really just thought that, all right, he was just being nice. Nothing's going to happen. He basically followed up and they messaged me and said that Bob Saget said that you were a really nice, like, funny girl or whatever. And we'd love to talk to you about doing a special. And I just thought that was incredibly kind. And he didn't have to do that in a world where it's so hard to fight for anything that you want, especially in a world as cutthroat as the entertainment industry. He didn't need to be that proactive and kind and helpful. So in my experience, he's a good one. He's one of the best.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
And now after a small break where I had to stop crying and I'm super embarrassed, I apologize. I wanted to say that I also genuinely missed you guys during the time off. Like, it was good for me probably not to record for a couple weeks, but it feels like it's been decades since we connected. I mean, taking a break from all these cases is not my strong suit in terms of I'm kind of obsessed with researching them. I enjoyed the downtime, but I also truly love doing this show, and I'm truly grateful for all of you listening. And I hope, during the time off, that you also enjoyed Mr. Greg Hunter's Christmas Truce episode. I loved it, and that story I had never heard of before, and unsurprisingly, based on the fact that I cried at the top of this episode, that story made me tear up several times. So Greg brings the heartwarming, and now I'm here to bring the heartbreaking. Listen, I wish this was a story that could soothe your soul, but unfortunately, it's one of the worst of the worst, and one that will make your head spin, just trying to figure out why. Why did precious little JJ and Tylee have to die? Why did Charles, Tammy, the list goes on of people in Lori Vallow and Chad Daybill's orbit have to die? Each person will get the tribute they deserve throughout this three-part series, and I promise I will do my best to weave one episode to another so this complicated web of crime is as easy as possible to understand. This is the story of Lori Vallow and Chad Daybill, and of Alex Cox and the complicated web of destruction they left behind them. It's also, more importantly, the story of two precious babies, JJ and Tylee, and Chad's wife Tammy, Charles Vallow, the grandparents who sparked this investigation and loved those kids so deeply, Kay and Larry, and so many others whose lives are forever scarred by the ultimate selfish acts of Lori and Chad. Selfish could be considered comparable with the sin of pride. Pride, which is the sin that leads to all other deadly sins. It is the deadly gateway sin that doesn't feel wrong because the committer has convinced themselves they are above the laws of man, that they are superior to most people, peers with the gods. And sinful pride is like an infection of the ego that swells until there is no room for empathy or compassion. There is only room left for the worship of the self and what the self deserves. I've never felt more sure that the sin I'm ascribing to this case was the correct one, because both Lori Vallow and Chad Daybill are so prideful, they can literally suck the energy out of any room. They exaggerate their importance and influence. Their pride has led to magical thinking and delusions of grandeur. Now, this case has been covered extensively by TV shows, documentaries, podcasts, all who have done an incredible job of bringing this to light. Some I'd like to shout out are Morbid's coverage, obviously, Hidden True Crime, who takes a super interesting psychological look, Mommy Doomsday by Dateline, with my hero and, sorry, Greg, maybe the love of my life, Keith Morrison, and We Saw the Devil podcast. The list goes on, but they are all doing incredible work. So that's why I originally never planned to cover this case, even though it aligned with the Seven Deadly Sinners culty, religious-y format. But I thought that so much was out there about it that I couldn't really contribute much more. But then, I'm getting ready and mindlessly listening to the Dateline podcast one day, and it's an update episode on this case, not the Mommy Doomsday one. So I'm listening, and a voice comes on, an interview of a friend of Alex Cox, Lori's brother. And I knew the voice sounded so familiar. It was one of my closest friends, Jill Kimmel, talking about her friendship with Alex Cox. It blew my mind. I had no idea they knew each other. I mean, Jill and I don't talk every day, but we're close. We've traveled the world together doing stand-up. I mean, we even slept in military barracks in Kosovo on a tour performing for the troops on pee-stained mattresses. We've had many first and many rewarding experiences together. Which, side note, that tour performing for the troops is probably the most important and proudest moment of my career. It was so rewarding and, yeah, means a lot. Anywho, like I said, Jill and I are close, but we live in different places, and it just didn't come up in conversation that one of the most widely talked about cases of the last few years directly had a connection to her. So Dateline only aired a small snippet of their 2-hour-long interview with Jill, and I needed to know more. So I texted her, and she agreed to give me her full rundown of her friendship with Alex and one of the most stunning revelations about a request he made to Jill right before one of his major crimes. Jill then also connected me to a woman named Mary, who's a total sweetheart, just like Jill. And Mary was Alex's kind of comedy BFF. Comedy friendships are their own breed. Like, you get close quickly. And both Jill and Mary had that close bond with Alex. And you'll be hearing clips from them both. And full interviews with them will be released on the Patreon. There's just so much interesting information that they gave, I could not include it in these episodes or they would have been way too long. So if you want to hear more, I will be uploading the full interviews to the Patreon at patreon.com/sevendeadlysinners. Okay, now let's get into the
crime. Good morning, George. And officials say there is no evidence that those children were ever in Hawaii. The mom, Lori Vallo, and her husband, Chad Daybell, skipped town after police came looking for her missing children.
When her brother shot and killed her ex-husband, there were several people present. To my knowledge, those people are all missing or dead.
It's been more than 5 months to face a trial over her missing children.
Where are your children?
Vallo's children, 17-year-old Tylee Ryan and 7-year-old JJ, haven't been seen since September.
The more we looked into it, the more it became apparent that we needed to take a second look and look a little closer.
He's breathing.
Okay, is he breathing normally, like his chest is rising and falling?
Obtaining the court order to exhume the body and have an autopsy performed.
So Lori at one time referred to herself as an empty nester.
It's my gun, it's a 45. I'm in police in an ambulance.
What's the emergency there?
I got in a fight with my brother-in-law and I shot him in self-defense.
Can you tell me where your kids are? Where are your kids? No comment? They've been missing for 4 months. You have nothing to say?
In July, Lori's ex-husband, Charles Vallo, was murdered by her brother.
Is he breathing?
I can't tell.
Are you willing to go over to him and check?
Sure.
Okay. This question many are asking has the mother of two missing children from Rexburg has been found, but the Fremont County Sheriff says...
That same brother of Lori's was found dead right before Christmas.
And where is the gun?
Chad's former wife, Tammy Daybell, died at her home.
That death is now considered suspicious.
A pistol, 45 caliber pistol.
So who is Lori Cox? Publicly more known as Lori Vallo. She was born on June 26, 1973, in San Bernardino, California, to parents Barry and Janice Cox. She had four siblings. Older sister Stacy, older brothers Alex and Adam, and younger sister Summer. They were devout Mormons, and almost no one took the religion more seriously than Lori. She wasn't fanatical back in those days, but she was committed. So much so that she attended seminary in the morning before her high school classes. One friend interviewed by Inside Edition, Bernadette Flores Lopez, said that, quote, "That takes a lot of dedication in high school to go before school to start seminary." She never spoke about what it meant to be a Mormon or anything. "I just know in her house there was a giant book of the Book of Mormon," end quote. But her deep faith didn't make her an oddball. Oh no, in fact, she was a bright, bubbly girl who made friends easily. Bernadette said, quote, "She clicked with Lori immediately when they met during tryouts for the high school cheer squad. I just thought she was a Barbie doll. She was a doll. She was just really, really, really friendly. Not like overly friendly, but she was just really sweet. I was just so excited to get to know her," end quote. Lori was a cheerleader. She was popular, but she wasn't wild during these times. She was family-oriented, and although the family didn't outwardly show much support or affection, according to Bernadette, she remembers that Lori's parents never attended her cheer performances. But that wasn't a red flag to her, necessarily. It just seemed that they kept to themselves. Bernadette also says that Lori attracted the attention of men, but that men weren't her priority at the time. Strange how people can change, or mask who they really are. Because Lori seems to put on superficial charm very easily for a while, until you get to know her. It wasn't until their senior year that she recalls Lori having a boyfriend. She said, quote, "There was hardly ever boys with us, but in senior year, that's when she started kind of branching out a little bit." And branch out she did. 5 times, in fact. And listen, I'm not shaming, but for a buttoned-up little girl's girl to go from no dating to 5 marriages, something must have changed. Unless, of course, it was always there and Lori was just so damn good at hiding anything she didn't want known in a particular moment. Crafting her persona was her forte. And while she got good grades in high school, she didn't attend college, but she did definitely attend the school of Lori, a place where she learned her whole life how to manipulate and coerce everyone around her to worship what was most important to her, Lori Vallow. Her self-indulgence seemed, by all accounts, a bit more mild in her youth, but perhaps picked up steam as she ran through husbands and opportunities to use people. Here's her brother Adam's wife recollecting her first impressions of Lori in an Investigation Discovery documentary called Doomsday, Where Are the Children? This is Nicole.
I met Lori in 1993. She came to Austin, Texas, where I met Adam, and she was going to Baldwin Beauty School. Extremely beautiful, outgoing, lots of fun, loved attention. She probably looked in the mirror more than anybody I know, and it was a running joke in the family. She loved to look at herself. She always had drama in her life. How could you not, being married that many times?
And one family member sympathetic to that drama was Alex Cox, the brother who would go on to do Lori's bidding, under the pretense that he was protecting her, her kids, their mission, to an almost obsessive degree. Alex Cox was a few years older than Lori. He worked as a truck driver, pursued stand-up off and on, and seemed to spend a lot of time fixing Lori's problems. Quick side note. By sharing these interviews with people who knew Alex, it is not to paint him as innocent or defend his actions, because they don't even defend him, actually. In fact, both express very strong thoughts on their disappointment in who he became and what he did. But it doesn't mean that they weren't friends at one point. And I think human beings are complicated and have many nuances. He was loving and helpful to his friends, and clearly to his sister to a very problematic degree, in my opinion. But he also had a shadier side.
Okay, I'm Jill Kimmel. I am a comedian
And I was living in Tempe, Arizona at the time of meeting Alex Cox. Alex was a comedian. He was a new comedian. I started doing comedy in July of 2006. Mm-hmm. And I started an open mic sometime later that year. It was probably October or November of that year. I started an open mic at this little, it was like a bar and grill called Bongos. Some normal people would be like, what? You know, for me, it was an obvious step in my career path. So
yeah,
it was really good for me because then, you know, you get to meet all the other comics in town and you get asked to be on shows and you see who's good and you can recommend them for shows. So having an open mic is like a really good way to meet the other comics and make friends. And once in a while, you really make friends with people. They're not just people who come to do your show. They actually become friends. And Alex was one of those people. Nerdy, like, oh, I'm always happy. He was like legitimately just happy and funny and very sarcastic, very smart, and just like a nice guy. And he would give me grief all the time. I would complain about my husband at the time. I'd be like, oh, and he would just tease me basically like, why are you still with him? And he'd always, you know, like be kind of like the fun, like, you know, like a high school buddy that you never dated, but just always like got along with really well. And he would just try to like give you advice and laugh and be like, all right, it's fine when you didn't take it. And he was just a really cool guy. He had a brother who was in radio. So I think he had kind of been dabbling for a little while, but he was very new. Like, I know that he had only performed at like one other open mic around town.
Mm-hmm.
So he couldn't have been doing it more than like 4 or 5 months at the time. And I was only doing it for about a year and a half at the time, or maybe just about a year or so. My brother, well, I guess for your audience, my brother's Jimmy Kimmel. So he had a radio show for a long time before his TV shows. That was kind of how he broke into the industry. And Alex had a brother named Adam who was also in radio. And we kind of bonded over that, you know, like just different things. And his brother got, you know, moved around a lot, just like Jimmy did. And we talked about how radio DJs would just get fired for no reason. They would just change the format and decide, okay, you're done. And they would make them use different names. And, you know, there was just a lot that we had in common.
That was Joe Kimmel, who we will hear more from later. And now, Mary Tracy, Alex's other friend I was able to catch up with.
Comedy community. And there were open mics 4 nights a week, and I could go anywhere and tell jokes. So one night I'm at this little club called Chili Bombers, and Alex was up. I had not met him before, and I thought he was quite funny, and I knew I was quite funny too. So I walked up to him afterward. He was sitting at the bar. He had a date with him, and I pointed at him, and he pointed at me. It was like simultaneous and so funny. And we both said, you're funny, at the exact same time. So it was just like, oh my goodness, we have to be best friends now, you know? So I had told jokes, I know, at Chili Bombers the week before. And so Sean wouldn't let me in his club. And I was calling Alex to whine, you know, and say, oh, poor me, I don't get to do this. And he said, ah, don't worry about it. Come over here and help me paint this bathroom. And so he was painting a friend's bathroom, and I went over there, and we're in this small bathroom painting this bathroom. And that's really how our friendship just blossomed from there. And then we were, yeah, just buddies. We talked every day, and we went and ate.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Drama followed Lori everywhere she went, specifically when it came to husbands. So let's do a quick rundown of that. Lori started dating her first husband in high school and then ran off and got married to him, but then shortly 6 weeks after, had it annulled in 1992. She then moves on to a guy named Will, and after dating for a bit, she gets pregnant and has her first child, Colby. They marry, but the relationship was constant drama, according to her brother Adam and sister-in-law Nicole, and in 1995, they divorced. After the divorce, Lori takes Colby and, you know, makes a go at single life. Her son Colby remembers this as a precious time, but a chaotic time. They were always moving around, and Colby was forced into an adult role, being his mom's confidant and caretaker. There was a lot of love, sure, and he says she did her best to brighten up what could be considered a very disordered time. Then Lori meets a man by the name of Joe Ryan. On another bright note, Lori and Joe produced a beautiful baby girl named Tylee. Both Colby and Tylee had adorable round faces and freckles as kids, and these two were as thick as thieves. Colby loved having a little sister. It was a small shred of normal family life amongst the chaos of what Colby describes as an explosive household at the hands of Joe Ryan. He recalls violent outbursts from Joe, abuse both physically and sexually. I cannot speak for the validity of any of that, and I always want to lean on the side of believe the victim. But what would come to be Lori's obsession with making it known that Joe Ryan hurt her kids became an obsession for her brother Alex as well.
Yeah. So the same way that she convinced Alex that Joe was molesting Tylee, mm-hmm. it'd be the same way that she convinced Colby that he was. And I don't know how that affected him. And no, it was kind of weird. And I didn't want to even talk about it, or I just probably would have tried to say, let's go write some jokes. Let's go eat something. Let's go do something. Like, I didn't want to talk about it. One time he wanted me to pretend like I had seen porn on Joe's computer. I don't know how I was supposed to have seen child porn on Joe's computer, but he wanted me to report that. And I said, no, I'm not doing that, Alex. I'm not doing that. So you have to understand mine and Alex's relationship, our friendship. It was very, he was a good friend, but it was very surface. Like, we joked around so much. So much that if he said, when he said something serious like that, it was like, blow it off. It was, I didn't take anything seriously that he said. So when he said, you need to call and report Joe's computer, I'm like, whatever, I'm not doing that. You know, let's go get something to eat. And so that's exactly how that conversation probably went down.
So Lori picks up and flees with her two small children. Meanwhile, Alex cannot stop thinking about revenge. He wanted to kill Joe Ryan. And Jill has a very poignant interaction with Alex to corroborate this.
Early that year, I remember he called me. And I was sitting in front of Bongo's, which was the place I would do the open mic. And I don't know if I was there to, like, pick up a check or drop something off or do something, or if it was, like, at night and I was on my way to the show. But I remember sitting in the parking lot in front of Bongo's and getting a call from him. And I was like, hey, what's going on? He's like, listen, I wanted to ask you, do you know where I could get a piece? And I go, a piece of what? And he says, a piece, like a gun. And I said, why would I know where to get a gun? Because I'm Italian? Like, at this point, I think he's joking. And okay. I'm like, I don't even like guns. Like, what? I don't know why you would think I would know that. And he's like, oh, I mean, I don't know. I just thought you might know. You know, you've lived in Arizona for a while. I thought maybe. And I said,
what?
Go to Walmart. Why would I know where to get a gun? What the hell do you even need a gun for?
What did he say?
And he said, well, I found out that my niece and nephew's dad or stepdad, I guess, their stepdad my sister's husband, soon to be or ex-husband, whatever he was, has been molesting my niece and nephew. I was like, what?
Wow.
He's like, yeah, my sister told me that they've been molested by him and I'm going to Texas and I'm going to find him and I'm going to put a stop to it.
I jotted it in my journal for some reason. He had to go to Texas for family reasons, for family business. Well, I didn't know he had gone there to attack Joe.
Not that way.
Yeah. And then when he came back and he actually told me that he had tased Joe, this is how stupid I am. I'm like, I didn't think that was a big deal. I didn't think that was anything. I thought it was just like a warning, like a, hey, buddy, I'm about to give you this little shock.
Joe Ryan survives this attack, and Alex spends 90 days in jail. Upon his release, the Cox family throws a barbecue to welcome him home. And this is the first time Mary meets Lori and the rest of the Cox clan.
I met Lori once at the family's house, and I never connected. Like, I didn't have a friendship with Lori. And at the time, when I met her at the parents' house, she was walking around in a bikini, and that's all I remember about her, is that was just so weird.
All the way down in a bikini, sure, but there's no walking around a party.
Right.
Certainly also not in front of my dad. Like that made me...
Never.
Like, it's just... She's a bad seed.
Well, it really affected me, too. It was shocking around her dad, around her two brothers. And I thought, maybe I'm just terribly prude. But that's not something I'd ever, for a lot of reasons, but even if I could rock a bikini, that's not something I would do.
Mm-hmm. It shows a bad sign of, like, look at me. It's weird.
I was the only person who I think nobody else indicated that they felt like it was weird. I didn't say anything that nobody else, I mean, it just seemed perfectly natural for everyone involved, for everyone.
Do you think that's because that she's kind of like the eye of the storm or basically mostly the storm in the family?
Yeah.
Just used to dealing with her?
That could well be it. It'd be just like, that's a Lori thing. That's just how Lori is.
Meanwhile, Lori is footloose and fancy free, busy with the next phase of her marriage saga. While cutting hair in Austin, Texas, a man by the name of Charles Bellow walks into the salon. He's around 49 at the time, Lori around 32. And it didn't take long for a new family to form. Charles and Lori were married in 2006. This was Lori's fourth marriage and Charles' second. He was first married to a woman named Cheryl and had two boys, whose names I'm leaving out as they have been requested several times in the media to remain private. Charles was a successful business owner, financial planner, who, by all accounts, adored the hell out of Lori. So much so that he made sure she had her infamous dance room in every house they owned. Literally, she took over the living room and put up mirrors along the walls and, you know, just danced her days away to 80s jams. My guess, living out some sort of high school Kevin Bacon fantasy. But Charles's love for Lori didn't end there. He also loved her children, Colby and Tylee. And life seemed perfect. I mean, minus the psychotic dancing in the living room. But even Lori's family was thrilled. Finally, someone else could handle Lori.
Alex's relationship with Lori is being like really kind of high maintenance. Like the things he would say about having to help Lori do this or do this or do this. And then I can remember that he was so grateful for Charles because it was like Charles was taking care of Lori. Here's Charles, this capable, lovely man. Mm-hmm. Who's taking care of Lori now. And I remember getting that feeling, not for any specific reason, but just like this sigh of relief that Lori's taking care of.
Lori was raised LDS, Charles Catholic. But when he met Lori, he was more than willing to convert to make her happy. But he also found that he actually loved the LDS way. They went to church every Sunday, and he was committed to the faith that Lori was so enamored with and devoted to. Her devotion seemed charming and normal. Well, until it didn't.
There's people around the country praying for your children, praying for you guys. Why don't you give us answers?
That's great.
That's great. That's great that they're praying for you, praying for your kids, what?
Fremont County Sheriff says still no sign of the children.
Right now we're gonna get the latest on those Idaho siblings missing since the fall.
The kids have not been seen since September. Their stepfather now telling us they are safe.
Mark, police say while they found Lori and Chad in Kauai over the weekend, there's no evidence that her children were ever there. Kauai police served Lori with a court order that says she has 5 days to physically produce the kids.
Thank you guys so much for listening. And if you enjoy the show, please leave a 5-star rating and positive review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Tell a friend. I mean, whatever. It really does help the show grow. Seven Deadly Sinners was created and written by me, Rachel O'Brien. Research and writing assistance by Kate Codman. Sound design and music production by Greg Hunter. And produced by Rachel O'Brien and Greg Hunter.